You are listening to Yadda Chat, a podcast produced by Yadda Yadda Noise.
And hosted by Alice Godber, who is currently studying an MA in creative practice at Hull College.
And Lucy Francis, who will come at the show from the education sector around the arts.
This podcast will interview Hull creatives and talk about our local industry.
The aim of this is to try and capture the wave of frustration the creative sector is going through, whilst also looking at some of the positives that might have come from these recent months. Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Yadda Chat. We're joined by Jill Howitt. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Alice. Hi, Lucy.
Hello.
So, Jill, for those listening who don't know who you are, would you like to tell us more about yourself?
So my name's Jill, and for most of my career, I've been a teacher. And for the last 20 or so years of that, was teaching at Hull School of Art and Design. Towards the end of that time, I became more and more kind of interested and inspired to organise and initiate my own projects, kind of working with other artists, creating opportunities and networks, and beginning to work outside of institutions and organisations. So, for example, I co-created Fountain 17 during the City of Culture year. So once I'd kind of taken redundancy from college, I began working on a number of things, including The Critical Fish, which Lauren Saunders and I set up in 2018. So we wanted to create a magazine, and in some ways it's not just a magazine, a project, to promote artists, writers, culture in the region, but also to address what we saw as a kind of lack of criticality during 2017. We felt that amazing things happened, but there was a lack of kind of critical discussion. So we wanted to address that and just have a forum for, you know, creatives, audiences, to kind of come together to discuss issues. And we're really interested in conversations, collaborative work. We're interested in people's work, what people want to do and the way they want to do it. So, yeah, since 2018, been working on The Critical Fish. I've also been doing my PhD, which for anyone who knows me will just think, oh, no, she's still doing that. But yes, I'm still doing that. And writing about public art in deindustrialised northern cities. So I'm writing about Hull, Middlesbrough and Liverpool. So I'm also currently working on a book with others called Listen, and that's celebrating the 60-year anniversary of Hull Samaritans. And so we're working with artists and writers, again, a lot of them in the area, local area, on a kind of creative response to that word. So, yeah, got a few balls in the air, so to speak.
In terms of that book, I didn't know it was 60 years since the Samaritans, actually. But what kind?
It's Samaritans in Hull.
And in terms of the artists that are involved in that, is there a variety in terms of the type of artistry?
Yeah. There's everything from a poet laureate down to a 7-year-old school child and everything.
Oh, really?
I mean, that's the way that I quite like to work on projects and themes, where, you know, you may have someone who's very recognised and quite established in the field, someone that's up and coming, you know, different age groups, different backgrounds, really. So that I suppose it's, in a sense, a bit more democratic. It's I believe that everyone's got the right to be involved in culture. And and I suppose the projects that I work on, I try to reflect that. So there'll be some familiar, like Tom's done something for Listen, and, you know, so I've drawn on people that I know in Hull, creative people in Hull, but also there's a committee of us working, so other people have invited others. So yeah.
Have you initiated that yourself then?
It was started off by myself and my husband, and then others that we knew from Samaritans have joined in the committee. So it's, you know, it's a bigger thing now, but yes, it was our idea to begin with.
So, Jill, how have you been during lockdown, and what have you been up to? What sort of changes have you had to make?
Well, I've continued working on all those fronts, really. And like everyone, it's been more difficult. It has been more difficult. And with Fish, we've had to really adapt and work in different ways than we would do normally. Just before lockdown, we were able to develop the website. We got a little bit of money from City Arts, Hull City Arts, so we developed the website. We identified four key areas or themes that we want to kind of have a bit of a specialism in, and those were conversation, young people, the theme above, below, at the edge of the water, and climate crisis. So we developed those themes. Also during lockdown, we've gone more official. So we've established ourselves as an organisation. We're an unincorporated association. We've got a constitution, a committee, officers. So those steps were necessary, I think, really. If we're going for funding, some funding does require you to be, although Arts Council didn't, but some funding requires you to take that extra step. And in a sense, if you're going for public funding, you probably need that degree of transparency and some of that kind of backup. So we've got a fabulous committee, really. It just means that we've had to set up in a more official way. Up until lockdown, we were really focusing on print issues of Fish. So we'd done two issues, and there were like two in each case. We had 2,000, and those involved a large call out. So we'd publicised call out to artists and writers to send in work. And then we may be working with quite a number of, maybe, I can't remember now, maybe 20 or 30 artists or writers per issue. So we were working on quite a large scale, really. There were also some public events like workshops, discussions, crits. So with lockdown, our funding sources that we used before completely dried up. We had no funding at all. And I think that's because what arts funding there was probably either going to established organisations or to individual artists to develop and keep their practice going. I might be wrong there, but that's how it felt. But for us, because we're, you know, our funding goes to support our writers and artists, if that makes sense. So we might use funding to pay a fee to an artist to do a piece of work or a writer. So we didn't quite fit those funding streams, although I did try, you know, I did send in quite a lot of applications. So anyway, our funding dried up and we couldn't work in the public ways that we've been working before. So really we shifted to working online, and I've really put all my focus into the above below page and gallery, which I think I'm so excited at the way that that's developed and the work that's accumulated on there. We've got people who've sent in their own kind of creative practice, printmaking, artwork, audio stuff. We've got stuff from scientists, historians. All of those different perspectives kind of meet on this theme, and I think it's really exciting the way that that's developed. We've now got some new articles in the pipeline which are exploring that theme from a slightly different angle. So we've got things around race and gender hierarchies. And so in some ways, one of the things that's come out of lockdown is that I found myself working a bit more slowly and a bit more closely, but with less artists and writers. So rather than having this massive call out and all this work coming in and then sifting through it and selecting and working on a much larger scale, I've worked on a smaller, more focused scale on one theme, perhaps talking with an artist or writer on how to develop something if that's what's needed, or just taking time for that theme to develop and accumulate. Sometimes you don't need to do that much. You need to just have a space to allow things to happen. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously it's brought its disadvantages, but in some ways there's been some advantages in that I've been able to work in different ways, and that's brought some interesting things, I think. We've also created conversations between people from different disciplines. So where we've got an artist and say a scientist, we've got them together and invited them to, you know, have a conversation and see how their different perspectives meet over the theme. So, you know, that's been interesting.
How do you put the call outs out then? How do you actually get the people coming through to it?
We'd use our networks to publicise a call out. Maybe we'd have one or two kind of arts press call out, so we might put it in artist newsletter or City Arts, you know, so we use some other platforms, plus our networks of galleries and organisations, and we'd invite people. That's how we work with the call out. We haven't done that over lockdown. It's been more, I mean, it does say on our website, anybody can, you know, respond to this theme above, below, at the edge of the water. But we've tended to either invite people fairly informally, word of mouth, that kind of thing. It's very difficult, to be honest, because without money, it's difficult to ask people to do things. There's a real issue about artists and writers not being paid, and no one on above, below has been paid to do any of the work. It's been voluntary contributions to the website. So I'm really mindful that of the ethics of that. So when we did the call outs before, it was when we were able to, you know, give a fee to writers and artists. I'm still, you know, thinking about the ethics of what we're doing, really. I suppose how I would put it is that we're asking people for maybe work they've already done, or for a snapshot of their work rather than a finished essay or a piece that they've had to work a long time on. We've perhaps said, just give us a snapshot of the work that you're doing in progress, and something that can be shared and people can see the connections with the other work, rather than asking for something that's hugely resolved and completed. But yeah, my hope is to get some resources so that we can pay artists and writers. I mean, what do you think, Alice or Lucy, about that issue with pay?
I think you're right. Like, it is quite a tricky subject to approach, especially if you're the, you know, the organisation that hasn't necessarily got funding, or like you have had funding in the past and obviously, you know, in lockdown. But then also as the artist, I think you have to sort of weigh up on sort of experience and then getting paid, because sometimes, you know, you get a lot of experience from volunteering and working on projects, and then other times, you know, it's great to get paid. You want obviously that, like, respect.
You are right, it is about experience, but it's about the experience that you can gather from potentially taking part in things that aren't paid. But it's also, it's the coverage, really. So like when I was performing, there was lots of times that we would do non-paid gigs and stuff, because it meant that people saw us. And it's the same with this, isn't it? Like, people are sharing ideas, people are talking and talking about their practice, and then hopefully the people who read that or see that will then engage with that practice, which is the idea, isn't it, really? So it's widening people's networks, which but it is a tricky one. And I was in a recent meeting with the Arts Council, and this was exactly the discussion around, where does it become, you know, like we're exploiting artists? But I think Alice is right as well. It depends on who that artist is, and I don't think at any point, as long as it's transparent and that that artist understands, then it's their decision, isn't it? And I think something like this is, it's an opportunity to share ideas, which actually doesn't come about very often now. Like, unless you're working in an industry where you do get to share your ideas and talk about your creative approaches, or lots of, particularly now, lots of artists work in isolation. But even before COVID, artists worked in isolation. So I think that particularly is a real draw for people, paid or not, that idea of actually collaborating and talking about their practice with other artists. That's, that in itself is, I think, quite a kind of rewarding process that not many people do once they leave education.
And I quite like the focus that has been on kind of work in progress, so people can try things out and get some feedback and some response, and it's maybe potentially even a little bit developmental, and it gives a different feel for it, you know, than perhaps something that's more expecting a resolved conclusion. I mean, very few people with their practice get to a point where everything's concluded and resolved. So to have a little snapshot of where they are at a moment and then get some feedback on that. We're super aware of the people that we work with, and if they can benefit from, you know, working with us, then we try to make that happen. So for example, we've got a very experienced editor on our team, and where possible, you know, if he works with a writer, that writer is going to really benefit from that feedback, you know. And we do work closely in that sort of more developmental way, so we hope to bring advantages to, you know, that scenario.
Like,
like mentoring, isn't it? And I remember I went on this producer exchange. The focus was about pay and obviously, you know, whether to work for free or, you know, what weighing up. And then another part was the sort of need for more mentors and the value it has on having someone there to sort of, I guess, guide you and help set goals for ideas that like back and forth. That in itself is really important to artists and sort of anyone trying to, well, you know, like learn and grab experience. I mean, Lucy, I see you as my mentor in like quite a few ways.
Oh, you know, like,
I don't think I would be where, you know, I am now if it wasn't for you. I think back to the spoken word night, I'd mentioned that it'd be good and you were like, well, go for it, do it. And then I was like, okay, I will. And it just sort of, it snowballed. And then with lockdown, you know, I went to you like, I want to sort of expand what I'm doing. And then we sort of just, we talked about it and then it sort of turned into what it is now.
But that's really... all you, it's all you. I mean, like you say, it is just having somebody else there that has conversations with you about it. But
yeah,
so it's all come from you. Like after that meeting at Westhall FM, we had one meeting and then you were off and you were working with them and then, and you know, and you've continued with all the writing network. So I'm just somebody that talks to you every week about it and maybe extends, I suppose, a bit like what Jill's saying around the criticality of what you're doing and the why you're doing it. We talk about the why a lot, don't we, which is important because that's the bit that gets you excited and pushes you on further because you're constantly thinking about the why.
About 18 months ago, someone from the local sixth form contacted me and said, could they do work experience with Critical Fish? And my first thought was, what experience is he going to have sitting at, you know, I just sit at the kitchen table working away. This isn't.
Yeah.
That's when I was doubtful. And then I thought, oh, yeah, well, actually, why not? And I would absolutely say there's no way that I've mentored him, but he's been such an asset to the magazine. It's just giving a space where he can do his ideas or his projects or suggest things. In fact, he's on our committee now and we've, as a magazine, we've, oh, that's great, that's a good idea, let's do that. So I wouldn't necessarily even say it's mentoring, although in some cases it's sometimes it's just saying, yeah, here's a space, do it, really. I am a believer in sometimes letting things happen rather than always shaping them, you know, or always trying to control what happens.
did he find you then, or did the careers advisor find you?
I don't know. I should maybe ask him. I went up to the school and I was quite doubtful. I had a meeting with the head of sixth form and then he's been phenomenal, really. I haven't done anything.
Going forward in terms of, I guess, you know, like we've been in lockdown for so long, do you think that something needs to be done in order to sort of help with the transition back to like group events? Because obviously, you know, all of us have spent all this time working from home and we've sort of found ways to do stuff like online events and, you know, social distance, you know, group of six when it's like applicable. But I think for quite a lot of people, the idea of, you know, a massive event, I mean, I've bought my Manchester Pride ticket the other week. And I remember at the time, you know, I was asked if I wanted to go. And my initial thought was, no, I really don't. Like, you know, I don't know how I'll be. But then at the same time, I had this like other part of me, like, you need to go because you need to sort of start. You need to try and get back to real life because we've been in this bubble and it's been like a really wild 12, 13 months. But it needs to, I don't know, we all need to sort of start moving out again. I don't know, I do think for a lot of people there'll be a lot of fear around that.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. I think the transition, you know, back into the world, however it'll be, is going to be really hard for some people.
Yeah.
And some groups have missed out hugely. And I suppose in an ideal world, there would be resources and spaces for those that have suffered and missed out. So I'm thinking like there are some very young children who haven't socialised at all. You know, they've been born in, my own new grandson, he's been born into lockdown. And he's never gone to a toddler group or hardly had anyone ever look after him. And I've got to start looking after him soon. And he's just not used to anybody. Now, that's a personal story, but there's young children at various different stages in their development who've really missed out on something, or older people who somehow their independence has and their self-reliance, you know, what might have taken 5 years to slowly lessen and diminish, that's happened much more quickly over a year, and they've lost confidence and independence. And students who've, you know, whose experience has been much more insular. So I don't know, in an ideal world, there would be thought put to that and spaces and resources to ease that transition. And I don't know, imaginative solutions, like all our art. I mean, this is maybe a silly thing to say, but when you hear of the schools going back and the concentration of children in one space, and then you think of other spaces that are still closed, like an art gallery or a museum or whatever, you think, oh, there might have been a more imaginative solution there. Yeah. Use public spaces more. But I don't know, that's out of my sphere, really. But I could imagine art spaces being used for some of those needs as we come out of lockdown, definitely.
I think you're right about younger children and social skills and things. I mean, I spoke about this in the first lockdown, just about my little boy, who at the time was three. But then again, he had social time. He had been at a nursery and he'd played with other children and things. Whereas now I've got a nephew who was born in the first lockdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, he's already standing up, probably about to walk. And I think I've held him once.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know who we are. And also just he's got serious, like, separation anxiety.
Yeah.
Like the other day, my sister needed to go to the loo or something, and she walked out of the room and he was just beside himself, because he's just, that's all he knows. It's bizarre, really, at that age.
We're in a similar situation, and you know, next Tuesday is going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
But poor Alice once had to, you were going to be back up for me with my first grandchild, weren't you? Do you remember?
Getting
on the train. Oh, Alice, you could be just there to help me.
Yeah, you sent me an email, you were like, Alice, if I were to get a train to Beverley or was it into Hull, and you were like, would you be able to help move the pram, like can you meet me and help me get the pram off the train? And I remember I was just like nice, yeah, I'd be honored.
Like, it was fine, and I was soon doing it without even thinking.
Yeah,
it's that first trip.
Yeah. That's forward thinking, that, Jill. Wow. I wouldn't have even thought of that. And there's been plenty of time where I've been getting off trains and I'm going, can somebody help? Can somebody help me? Next time I'll use Alice.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm here for all pram needs. Manoeuvring off trains. Yeah, open call on the podcast if anybody needs help with a baby.
Alice is your gal.
Yeah.
Only if you're going into Beverley there.
Yeah, I don't travel, sorry.
Yeah, you don't travel well, do you?
No. So, Jill, do you remember the one about, it was basically suggested that, you know, creatives should retrain in cyber. This is sort of, it's been ongoing throughout this podcast series, just because, you know, we were sort of thinking about it right at the beginning, like, oh, you know, this would be quite interesting to talk about. And so me and Lucy both did the quiz, and it came back that Lucy is, she's basically born to be a manager, because her roles included head chef, retail manager, and there was another one which was also,
I can't remember the other one, but yeah, it was something on that line.
And my options were horse groom, soldier, or massage therapist.
So soldier, I mean, the soldier one's the funniest for me now, and it's just hilarious, that one.
Well, I just don't think I'd pass the fitness test, if I'm honest. You have to do a fitness test, don't you?
I think you need to have like a full health MOT, don't you?
Well, there's no chance of that.
But this, Alice, this is what you'd be on. I just noticed this. One of my boys' army vehicles, and I'm just imagining you in that.
Sat in it, sort of being like travel sick. So basically, Jill, did you have a look at the quiz, or have you had any thoughts of what you maybe would do hypothetically if you were to sort of step away from
the creative arts?
The way that I thought about this was I don't need to retrain because I'm semi-retired, as in I've got a small pension. I do need to earn a bit of money, but I feel like although I might want to train in things that are useful to me, I don't know how to put this, but in a sense I'm not in a place where I have to fit into existing job roles or fit into society's roles. Like I'm past that.
I'm so over it.
I've worked as a teacher for 40 years. I've been a single mum of three. I've been a blended mum of five. You know, I've done those things that you're doing. I suppose now what I'm exploring or experimenting with is something else. I don't know what it is yet, but it's something else. Like, what is my own practice? You know, what is it that I would do or can do or want to do outside of those roles and necessities?
I think that's fair enough. I'd love to be at that stage, to be honest.
But it's not also not that easy. Like, it was for me, it was so difficult finishing work. It's one of the hardest things because I always thought of myself as a teacher. And so to stop teaching was a real... But it's also exciting finding your practice, whatever that is. Like, what is it you would do, you know, outside of that job? And I'm still looking at that and still thinking about that. So I would do training or some sort of work around my own writing. So I'm interested in developing that and how I want to write about art. So having taught it for all those years, you know, I'm interested in writing in different ways and less academic ways and less conventional ways. So I'd be interested in developing that, and also interested in developing the ways that I work with other people on projects like Fish. But I don't think I need to be a horse groomer or a chef or whatever it is. You know, I'm sort of past that. And what I'm into, I don't know. I haven't put my finger on it yet, but it's a different sort of space. And it sounds luxurious, but it's quite difficult as well. If you've, you know, like I was very used to turning up to work and doing as I was told, really. I was quite respectful of that and quite enjoyed being part of that. So doing something different in different ways is exciting, but it's also a challenge. Anyway, I didn't do the quiz for that reason.
Do you have anything like when I got the head chef thing? I was a bit like, oh, wow, I actually would love that because I love cooking, even though I don't think I do it all that well, but I enjoy it. So I was a bit like, oh, yeah, I would do that. And although, to be honest, I do think that is a very creative subject. Yeah. You could almost say that I was an art subject in a sense. But anyway, that's irrelevant. But is there anything, I suppose, in terms of hobbies or anything that you have outside of your creative practice that if you really were pushed to, you would say, oh, well, that would be a route that I would go down?
Okay, so maybe a philosophy degree, some maths. I would have, I've got a secret mathematical side.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I used to think I would have liked to have been a midwife.
I think you'd be a good midwife.
I wouldn't want to give injections or nothing.
You've got a good voice. I can imagine your voice being very soothing as a midwife.
I mean, and I am involved in other voluntary organisations which bring out different facets, you know. So I have got other things that I do that are other than creative.
Yeah.
I'd love to have been a runner. Yeah, I'd love to run. When I see people jogging and their ponytails bobbing up and down, I just think I'd love to be you.
But... Yeah. To be fair, like, So basically, I'll be like laid in bed and all of a sudden I'll just be like, I should really, do some exercise.
Do a couple of press-ups.
Yeah, and then I'll just sort of be laid in bed. Like, I don't ever do it. Yeah, and I'll be like, just imagining myself like doing like maybe like 10 press-ups.
Yeah, this morning I have done 10 press-ups, but I've done that because I've been told that it's a new manifesto that my friend has written for me. She's a nutritionist and she's set me a manifesto, and so my morning routine now has to include 10 press-ups. So this morning is my first morning where I have done exactly that, Alice.
What are the odds?
I've done 10 press-ups and I've done 5k, but that's all I've done.
Did you run 5k?
Yeah, I tend to run 5k sort of. I try to do it maybe 2 or 3 times a week.
That's fantastic.
It's just me like manifesting push-ups in my head. No, I just would do it.
That's where they will remain.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, 10 press-ups is fine. You'd be fine, Alice. Give it a shot.
No, yeah. Like, I genuinely, like, when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, I want to do it. But I just, like, there's literally no reason why I'm not doing it.
I'd like to run further, but my knees are shot. I don't know about you, Jill, if you've ever did run, but my past 5K, my knee just struggles, my right knee. Mm-hmm. People can run for miles, can't they?
Yeah, it's just the freedom. I walk, and I can walk quite a long way. I've got a false hip. And since I had that, I thought, I have walked a marathon since then, which really surprised me. So I don't know whether it'll wear out quicker as a result. But it was a marathon walk around London and I thought, oh, that's fine, I'll just join in, and then because I'll always be near a tube station, I'll be able to get the tube to the finish. But then I ended up doing the whole thing. So I don't think I could do that now, but
Were your legs like jelly afterwards? I walked 22 miles once and I couldn't walk for about 3 days.
It was really painful straight afterwards, which was a shame because we went to a pub and we had proper pie and mash and things like that. But my legs were really hurting straight afterwards, but it wasn't too bad the following day.
No, really? That's good. Yeah. I did the three peaks, so that's, I think it's 22 miles. I wouldn't advertise that to anyone, to be honest. I mean, at the time I was running a lot. I was probably running 10Ks then. And I thought, I'll be fine. And I was just horrendous. I was like, I just need this to end. It was awful. Oh, it really was.
You say that like people were getting like airlifted off and stuff?
Well, somebody that I knew had previously been airlifted off, yeah. So I'd kind of thought, well, if I don't get airlifted off, then it's, you know, that's a bonus. Yeah. But when I got to the sort of the beginning of the third peak, because there's like obviously like aid stations, well, not aid stations, but stops where you can go and have a sit down and a Haribo. And I stopped at this last one and I thought, but I was with a load of friends. We were all doing it for charity. I suppose, you know, you don't want to be the only one that says, do you know what, kids, you carry on. So I was like, yeah, definitely come in. Yeah, great. And the third one on the way up, you actually had to like actually rock climb, like actually. And I was just like, this is like a joke. It was ridiculous. It really was. And you have somebody walking behind. Well, I say behind you. He was behind me because he was at the back and we were right at the back. And he's like literally almost like pushing you. He's going, come on, Nert, you're not at the right pace. You've got to get this done sub 12 hours. You've got to get it done sub 12 hours. Come on. So he's pushing you and you're like, oh, honestly. Anyway, but we did it. And it was, by the end of it, it felt like an achievement. But at the time, it felt like pure torture.
I mean, this is nowhere near on the same level, Lucy. But I remember when I did a 10K. And bear in mind, okay, I do nothing at all. We did it with a bunch of cricketers in memory of my dad because he was supposed to be running the 10K and he was training for it. And so I like took his number and like a load of people, you know, those like all my dad's team like wearing like all the whites and stuff. And we were like, yeah, sure, like, yeah, let's do it. And I'd never walked that far. Well, I say walk, like, because I walked it. you know, there was like a bit of jogging involved, but yeah, it got to the point where like we literally had someone behind us and the roads had opened. and so we were sort of like, you know, in the middle of traffic and then, you know, I got to the point where, like, there was, like, a finish line, and I saw there was, like, two people in front of us. And I was like, right, well, we have to, like, overtake them, obviously, just out of...
pure determination.
Yeah, pure determination. So sort of, like, ran this last 10 metres or something and managed to do it. And, yeah, I'm pretty sure it took us 4 hours to do a 10K.
I think it sounds more like a just something that was good to do rather than worrying about the time you did it in.
Yeah, I mean, like, I look back now, and there were parts of it where it was, like, obviously really nice and, you know. So, Jill, what are your hopes for the future and what would you like to see happen?
Okay, so in the very immediate future, as far as Fish is concerned, I would love to bring together a print issue of Above Below. I would really love to do that. I think that the combination of articles and images shines like a particular light on arts, activism, nature recovery, climate crisis. It's like the combination of things, I think, is quite significant, like the different perspectives coming together. And I've often asked myself the question, what can the arts do really in terms of changing attitudes towards the environment or climate crisis? Like, what exactly is that relationship? Like, try to pin it down or write it or speak it out loud. But somehow through all these different pieces of work, I think that question is not exactly answered, but I think it becomes clearer. So yeah, I would really like to bring together a print issue of all of those articles and all of those pieces of artwork. I think that would be really exciting. And if possible, connect it, you know, with something that's happening in the city, like, you know, like the Shorelines Project or something like that. I've been quite interested in art projects from the recent past that have also looked at the relationship between the city and the rivers and seas. So something like that, like the Shorelines Project, which I think is really exciting. It's got threads back to previous works and previous projects, which could potentially get lost, because if they're not permanent things, if they're events or performances, you know, they could disappear a bit. So one of the things that I'm trying to do on Fish is to bring together, you know, some kind of representation of those previous projects, making sure that we've got a record of those. I'm currently writing, actually, in my PhD, about two pieces of work which literally illustrate the rising water level. So there was a text piece that used to run on the wooden barriers below Myton Bridge and on either side. And literally, as the water rose and fell, the text appeared and disappeared. So that seems to be quite a graphic representation of the relationship with rising water levels. So that was by an artist called Lawrence Weiner. And the other piece was by Anya Galaccio, and it was a pillar of chalk, I think, that was placed in the basin, in the river basin, and gradually eroded and disappeared. So there's connections with previous pieces that I think are good just to register and make that connection.
We've been working with The Hague University recently. We've had last year we actually took students to The Hague. This year that we've attended the business games that they do online. When we went to The Hague, there's obviously they're of a similar sort of vein to us in terms of water levels and things. Yeah. But they have a piece in the centre, which is, it's basically, it shows the waterline and where the actual waterline is, but it's a sculpture as well. And there's multiple sculptures around that central area that are all about the kind of waterline, and it's a beautiful area. And then also, I don't know if you've seen in Rotterdam, I think it's Rotterdam, they've got an area that's made to actually fill with water. So, but when it's not filled with water, you can sit at it and people have, you know, it's like a social area. And then once the water levels rise, it's an architectural kind of adaptive space according to living with water, which is something that I think we as a city need to get better at, maybe, in terms of celebrating it a bit more as well as getting prepared for it.
Yeah. One of the benefits of lockdown is that a lot of events are available online. So I've joined this Coastal Histories Network. I just love their events and symposiums and webinars and things, and I would never dream of going to one, you know, because I would feel very underqualified. But the benefit of that is this cross-disciplinarity and hearing from geographers or historians or archaeologists about these spaces and places. So that's been one benefit for me of lockdown, is going to coastal histories. Yes, that's an immediate thing that I'd like to do, is to bring together an above below issue. I'd like to finish my PhD. I'm not sure if I can.
How far along are you?
30th of November, Alice.
Wow.
And the thing is that I've been doing it for so long and it's been such a valuable process. If I never finished it or wrote it up, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Like, I've got so much out of it. Fish is in a way a kind of public project that is related to things that I found out. Fountain was, you know, so I have got so much out of it, but it's such hard work.
Yeah. I remember the I think we were on the first year of RBA, and I think you were you like 3 years into it or something, or you know.
Yeah. And the thing is, only just before Christmas I found out that all the footnotes, which is so long, they all count in the word count. So I've suddenly got to lose tens of thousands of words, and that's quite defeated me. I thought that was the whole point of footnotes.
Yeah, I didn't know that they counted.
That's what I used to teach students. If you want to add a word, put in your footnotes, or you know, it all counts, even every image caption, and I've got hundreds of images.
Oh, what? So,
that's why I feel a bit defeated. But yes, I would like to finish it, and I probably will.
You will.
Yeah.
You will.
For the magazine, I'd like more resources, really, just to do what we're doing, you know, and to be flexible, to respond to ideas that people have and different, you know, people that want to come on board and different circumstances. So to have some more resources to do what we're doing would be amazing. Obviously want to carry on publishing thought-provoking articles and artwork and making opportunities, you know, on a bigger scale, if that's what you're asking, what's my hope for the future, like the world peace type scale. It would, like everyone must have said this, it would be lovely to come out of lockdown having learned something and into a more caring, less ruthless society. It would be lovely. Yeah. Think that we learned something, and that we can create a more socially and environmentally aware form of capitalism. I think that's like crucial, really crucial.
I think it's not unlikely, to be honest.
Do you?
I think a lot of attitudes have changed.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. I mean, I think even just the kind of the approach to work and that work-life balance, and I know that that's been a big discussion in the college, and
has it?
Yeah, it has been a discussion, and it is in my new role that I've taken on, I think. And also as an employee, I think you feel more able to address that, really, because I certainly, like, from the first lockdown, learned a lot in terms of, you know, why am I working, you know, 10-hour days or whatever, and you know, rushing the kids out the door in the morning, barely looking at them, and then rushing down the motorway at 5:45 to not be late to pick them up, rushing to get some food that's not nutritional, rushing to get them bathed and in bed. Everything was just so, and then lockdown, certainly, as much as obviously there's loads of stuff out there about, you know, God, get the kids, get back to school and stuff, it certainly, I think, from a parenting point of view, made me address what's actually important. I mean, why are you actually working? You're working for them, but then you're not actually engaging with them as you should, or I certainly wasn't. And just that kind of corporate sort of response, I think, has been similar, like working with a few companies that we work with at the college, and also Leo's, who some of the companies he's been shooting recently and stuff, they're all saying the same thing, that potentially they might not go back full time into the offices, or like in London where my brother-in-law lives, apparently there's companies kind of closing or stepping out of office spaces and just saying, actually, we don't need this anymore. I don't know what it will do in terms of the economy if lots of people let go of leases and things, but certainly from a kind of personal relationship point of view, I think it's that is one of the positives, definitely.
I have worried about young people who are starting out on their careers, and they may be in a place because of their job, like my first jobs. I was only in Bristol because I'd got a teaching job there. Mm. And if I hadn't been able to go to work, it would have been far harder to. So I think at different stages in your life.
Yeah.
But I think for young people, it's very hard to work from home all the time.
So it is. It's true. Yeah. I mean, I had a meeting yesterday with somebody who's new to the college and just doesn't feel integrated at all. And that's right. Yeah. I'm in a very different position than somebody who's just starting in a career. I would hate to be. I mean, I'm about to start in it in a new institute. But luckily, I am going on to site. And if I wasn't, and if I was still going to be sat, I mean, I was sat here for my interview. If I was still going to be sat here when I was about to take on, you know, new teams and things like that, I would have found that really hard. Touch wood, that doesn't happen, and am I allowed on site? Yeah.
And I suppose as far as the arts are concerned, if things could be led more from the bottom, kind of bottom up rather than top down, so faith in grassroots organisations, artist-led initiatives, you know, so there's more the sense of those being at the heart of things. Often they're at the end of things, you know, so have an idea there, and then it'll go through all the planning and the councillors and then, we need some artists now to create social cohesion in that place. Let's get them in, you know, and then they come in at the end. So I've seen some really fabulous artist-led, socially aware, socially engaged projects. And you also see places where artists are used, exploited, instrumentalized, you know, so I think for me, it would be great for there to be a real focus on grassroots, not just in art, in sport, in all sorts of things. Yeah, artist-led organisations and initiatives. I think that would be really powerful. And then going forward as well, I don't know if there's any way of some kind of payback for those that have really missed out. You know, some kind of, I don't know, opportunity, like some students who've, you know, my niece, she'll have done most of her second year and a lot of her third year at home, you know, studying. That's not what you signed up for being a student. So whether there's some kind of opportunities that can be given them and, I don't know, travel or something a bit more outward facing.
I'd really like to sort of almost go back and do our degree show, because that's obviously, well, you know, with a fine art degree, it's what you know, you spend the whole time on your course. It's a bit like you're a first year, so you need to help us, you know, prepare. And then second year, it's like you get a show, but, you know, don't take too much sort of the limelight away from the big degree show. And then it finally got, we were like, yes, it's our time, you know, we started preparing for it. And then lockdown. So it'd be nice to, I don't know, do something.
Maybe you should.
And we've talked about it, and hopefully, I mean, really, the gallery and everything is not, you know, overbooked by any means. So I think we need to look at that for next year in terms of how we celebrate past work that's not being seen through all of this COVID. Because we don't, I mean, at the moment we're planning for an end of year exhibition this year, but you don't know, do you?
And if the arts community in Hull, you know, worth anything, of the different communities, they should be really rallying around students who've missed out these opportunities, really. Like, fish couldn't do much, but we do what we can, because that's so important, really. So you'd have a lot of people behind you if you wanted to do something.
Yeah, you would.
I mean, one of the things that I've sort of been reading about in my research is how important that link between, you know, undergraduate students or postgraduate students, like at the School of Art and Design, how important that relationship is with the cultural things that happen in the city. You know, I've been looking back at things that were happening in the 1980s and 1990s, and it's because of the students, really. It's because of students coming there, studying there, and then perhaps staying on and doing things like that you're doing, Alice, you know. So if the city had an opportunity to somehow support the things that you've missed out on, I hope that they would, really.
Yeah. So, Jill, how can people find out more about you and the Critical Fish?
Well, we've got a website, which is just thecriticalfish.co.uk. We've got a Gmail as well, so you can contact us via the website. You know, there's a contact bit, or we're criticalfish@gmail.com. And we've got Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, thanks to Tom. So, yes, all the normal ways. We're really happy to hear from people. If they want to get involved, you know, we try to be as open as we can be. If people want to give us feedback or present an idea that they would like to do, or work that they would like to do, that's fabulous. You know, that's what we want to do, really. So just get in contact, really.
Brilliant, thank you. It's been lovely chatting to you, Jill, and it's really nice catching up.
Yeah, it's really nice to speak to both of you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Jill.
All right, well, take care, look after yourself, and we'll speak soon.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Yellow Chat. You can find out more about this podcast and platform through visiting our website at www.yada-yada-noise.com. You can also follow our social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all at Yada Yada Noise.
Yada.